up here, just let me make a couple quick comments, if I may. The University of Iowa is going to be okay, and they have a plan for other universities, and we have been working with conference calls, I know, with some of our partner institutions and universities, so they'll be all right. Stockpiling may pay off. I think that's a good thing. And visiting nurses are going to come to work, and I think that that's a good thing. All good things come to an end. I am it. Okay. I am the first name of the many that you see up there who worked on something that basically I think is one of many things that keeps me awake at night. It doesn't take much, really. I practice emergency medicine at UCLA's emergency department, have a joint appointment in the School of Public Health, and direct our Center for Public Health and Disasters. And for about a decade, we have been directing our attention to working with health departments and preparing them for responses to large-scale emergencies. As we confront the inevitability of a pandemic influenza, I don't know what strain, I don't know when it's coming. One of my concerns has been, what are people like me going to do when something like this happens? What are the practicing clinicians in hospitals going to do when confronted with a large influx of very sick people? Will they be able to implement pandemic plans into practice? I'm not sure that we know the answer to that question. We have these sort of up here in terms of sort of guideline questions. I guess to attempt to answer the question, I thought maybe what we should do is ask some of these guys, the ER physicians and nurses and infection control people, hospital administrators, those sort of folks. And so we decided we would do some key informant interviews with people who should know the answer to this, or at least be thinking about what they are going to do. And this is how we set it up. We looked at five different groups of clinically related people, hospital administrators notwithstanding. If there are any of you here, don't take that personally. And then these interviews were recorded and transcribed and looked at. Key informants, okay? We wanted to get specific folks who do specific things. We did this in Los Angeles, okay, so it's a little bit biased. LA, as you know, is the hub of all good things, including the Iowa scenario for the point of entry for pandemic influenza. Thank you very much. But we felt that if we could just touch base with some people who work in big hospitals, small hospitals, public hospitals, private hospitals, ask them some questions, maybe we would get somewhere. So from both this is what we were sort of interested in, really. We had four general themes. Talk to us about the supplies and resources of your institution for PanFlu, triage parameters that you might use, quality of care issues. This is a big one for me. My contention is that when this happens, we're not going to be able to do everything for everyone. And people much more ethically cool than I am have been thinking about this for a long time and grappling with this at state legislative levels and philosophical levels and every other level. And I'm not sure that we have answers yet. And maybe they're just unanswerable. And the last piece is there's some authority in your institution that will guide you in terms of what you're supposed to do. From a practical and ethical perspective, it's the middle two that bug me. And those are the ones that I wanted to know about. So we've got a small number of people who do this stuff in different hospitals. And we wanted to talk to them. All representatives, all the groups up there expressed some concern about the mechanics of triage, the mechanics of it. What's the site going to be like? Will we have enough people to do this? Will we have infection control at our triage site, personal protective equipment? Gee, what if we have to move somebody from point A to point B in our hospital after we triage them? A lot of operational questions were coming up. You know where I'm going with triage. How am I deciding who gets what? Okay. This is what was on their minds, and particularly the ER doctors, nurses, and the infection control folks. So their responses to me suggested that they had no anticipation that a pandemic flu was going to pose any special triage problems whatsoever. And if you look at some of these, I love some of these. They're just great. There's some classics up there. The first and second one, the Ever Ready Bunnies, those are the nurses. And the physicians have no ethical concerns. Okay, it's great. and the bottom one I thought was a real kick, too. I suppose we could pull out the disaster plan and see what's in there. Okay. So, you know, I mean, so these are the kinds of comments that came from people who are going to be on the front line. so then we're not getting where we want to go. So we said, look, let's get to the issues of stratification of the quality of care if you have to triage. And so what we did was we had a few questions that we would pose to try and engage them in thinking about these issues. One was, what are some ethical concerns you might have relating to triaging patients within your clinical setting? Okay, it's hard to be any more point blank than that. And the other one is, if a new patient arrives at your facility in an advanced stage of illness, do you have any concerns if you have to triage them to someplace else? Okay. So we figured if we prompted them, we would be just basically hitting them in the head with a hammer to see what happens. And so it was as though this was not on their cognitive radar screen. Everyone gets everything. We're going to treat everybody the same. There are no different concerns for pan flu. Whether they're urgent or not, everybody gets the same. This already is not true because I know how it is in my shop when I work, and it's falling apart. It does not work. I got to give you my favorites. This is a beauty. Lower quality of care is a totally foreign concept to this organization. It's always do the max for everybody. Get the Cadillac out for that person. Maybe Cadillac has a better reputation than it used to. And the last one is, what about the liability components? Who do you suppose that came from? The hospital administrator. Okay, just so that we're all thinking the same way. So it's in there somewhere, I'm sure of it, but it is not on the front burner. It's just not out there. So we got a bigger hammer, okay? And we prompted them with these kinds of questions. If you have to restrict care to a particular patient based on anticipated survivability, what are some of your concerns in triaging them home or perhaps to a hospice setting? What are some ethical concerns that might challenge your ability to give sufficient care to patients if their triage based on survivability would occur? Okay, it's more point blank than the last point blank. If you had to provide a lower quality of care than typically delivered under non-emergency situations, what are some of your concerns? And so we asked those questions, and we generated these kinds of answers. Doctors are going to establish the scale. Okay, that's nice. This is an important one. The biggest concern is the emotional wear and tear on the staff having to do this. In this case, this was from the emergency department nurses. And another one from one of the physicians, I don't think we have that kind of experience to do this. So the infection control people say the doctors are going to do this, and the doctors are saying, hold it. We don't live in that world. I mean, we're used to our own mess of triage every day, but not like this. The nursing supervisor sort of got the message, which is you can't save everybody. You're going to have to reallocate resources. So now we're starting to get there, okay? And while somebody thinks the doctors are going to do it, the administrators think the government's going to tell them how to do it, which is the last one, okay? So when you raise the issue enough times in enough ways, you can get their attention and they'll start thinking about this and they're looking for answers because they don't have them. What was really fascinating is a number of people interviewed spontaneously brought up the topic of public education and concerns over the public's behavior in this. This was not something we specifically targeted. It just sort of arose from the conversations. And the issues were very much, how do we educate them in terms of what to look for? Where do they go? What should they do? What are their reactions going to be? What about vulnerable populations? It's a real issue for our health officer who thinks about that one all the time. What about the worried well? And specifically, I don't feel comfortable that public health has taken a really strong role in helping us filter out these people. Okay. I found that one interesting too. There's inadequate community-wide education. I think that's a good piece. I think that's true. And people are still going to come to the hospital because, and you know what? That's where they go. And you can try and stratify them wherever you like. But if they live in a certain area and this is the hospital that they're accustomed to using, they're going to that door. It's very common practice. We see it all the time in non-situations like this when we try and redirect patients because we are crowded or another institution is crowded to go elsewhere. They don't want to do that. They don't want to do that. And then regarding, this was a beaut, regarding guidance from the local public health leadership. The last one was a real killer. These are people who work in my catchment area. These are my fellow doctors and nurses in Los Angeles. The Department of Health is some mysterious agency I've never seen. I've never heard from them. We don't know who they are. Okay? Now, when I talked about this very point to Jonathan Fielding, who's our health officer, just before coming in here, I said, Jonathan, nobody knows who you are. I said, they don't hear from you? He said, that's not true. We're sending, you know, notices and, you know, and mass faxes and everything all the time about communicable diseases and things like that. I said, well, you know, if you're going to deal with this issue, there's a huge hole somewhere that this is all falling into because the clinical practitioners are not getting it. They're just not getting it. So what do we make of all this stuff? And then hopefully we'll have time to, you know, to hash it all out. It's sort of like this, I think. There's two sides to everything, and here's one side. One of the nursing supervisors said, oh, is there going to be a pandemic? Is it going to be in our lifetime? It may not be in her lifetime. It will be in somebody's lifetime. It will be in, if not my generation, looking around here, your generation, looking around again, even your generation, but it'll be out there, okay? And the question is, what are we going to do with it? The opposite side of the coin is, from the administrators, I love it. Oh my God, it's going to happen. What do we do? What do we do? So there's really two sides to every one of these things. Except for some people, there's a third side. I mean, right. You got it. So, you know, so what can we draw from this? Not a lot. It's a qualitative peak. It's LA specific. But these were different kinds of institutions, large, small, public, private. Their staff assignments were different. They were doctors, nurses, infection control people, administrators, nursing supervisors. And they all provided a little bit of a glimpse into some common themes that, you know, that are responsible for my being tired all the time. Okay, I'm awake all the time with this stuff. Some people are starting to think about this. Others are just not there yet, and it's just not pressing for them. So as a very close colleague of mine says, when so many truly inconceivable situations come up, how is this possible? How is it possible? Especially since this has been going on here for 7 years. Okay? This is 2000, was the influenza pandemic plan, the federal plan came out. It's not news. You can just sort of rattle them all off. Since 2000, HHS issued their national influenza preparedness plan. In 2005, the national strategy to safeguard. 2006 to 2007, we spent $400 million distributed to states for pandemic influenza planning. In March, hospital pandemic influenza guidance came out in LA County, and our hospitals were all our HRSA-funded hospitals were required to have a plan by March, I believe, of this year. And there's a checklist out there that was put out in September. So you can see that this is not a novelty item. My concern is that there's been a whole lot of activity going on, but we're not going anywhere. You know, are we getting our clinical practitioners integrated into the practical implementation phases of pandemic influenza response planning or not? And if we're not, how's it possible? I mean, how can that be? So I think we need to scratch the itch. This has been a 7-year itch. This has been going on since 2000. In our shop, when we work with our health departments, we sort of have a 5-point game plan. Whatever the curse of the year is, you have to assess the need. What is this going to do to your population? What's the impact going to be? What do we have in place? Let's design a plan, whatever it is. Let's train our people to the plan at all important levels. And then let's exercise the plan, because if we don't practice this, we're going to be in a very bad way. I ran into Mark Horton before, who's the public health director for the state of California, and we had worked with him when he was in Orange County. We had worked with the current Orange County health officer as well on primarily public health emergency planning and response, and we helped them develop plans and these sorts of things. Now, unless you've been living in a closet for a while, you're aware that California burned to the ground, basically, a couple of weeks ago. And they activated their emergency operations centers. And they functioned as though they had done this many times before because they had planned, they had practiced, we exercised them, and it wasn't perfect. But they got the lingo. They started to feel like what this is supposed to be, and it wasn't totally foreign. And then you have to evaluate what happened. And Mark asked us to help facilitate an after-action report for them, and then revise it and start over again. It's an iterative process. So I don't know where we are with all this stuff. I think that basically we have assessed the need and we are designing plans and we have allocated money and we have lots of plans are out there. The disconnect to me is that we haven't trained our clinical people to what the plans say and what they're supposed to do. And we certainly haven't had a chance to exercise it very well. So I'm afraid that if we don't get on with this pretty soon, we're going to wind up like this. You'll have a pandemic plan that governments and administrators may know something about, but you won't stand a chance if the practitioners who are supposed to implement these plans in the clinical setting don't have any idea what this is all about, and they just don't, they're not part of the preparedness process. So in my view, scratch the itch. That's it for me. Thanks.